Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
From the icy reaches of Montreal, Canada, Solid Gold Effects are effects pedal creators who constantly reinvent the wheel with their wonderful devices. If you, like us, are looking for something more than just another chorus, fuzz or flanger, then that's exactly what Solid Gold Effects do best. From the Oblivion, a quadruple-voiced flanger with a whole bunch of internal dip switches, to the Lysis, a polyphonic octave down fuzz modulator, Solid Gold are just a great shout if you want to do something different, make weird noises, or if you're just looking for something a bit more fun. Check out their range of ultimately original soundscape devices at solidgoldeffects.com. We think they're wicked. Hello and welcome to the Guitar Nerds Podcast, the world's number one guitar podcast. I am your host, Joe Branton, joined this week by Matt Knight.
Hello there.
And Jay Cross.
Hi there.
Exactly, yes. Season 2, episode 10. 10, we're in double figures. Double figures, finally.
I feel so much more professional now I've got this new mic stand holder, Joe.
Oh, yes, I did get you a new mic stand because, I don't know, listeners, you might be... I tried to get rid of them in the episodes when it happened, but, Matt, you were constantly banging your mic stand, and it's like... It's got, like, a spring on it, and so it would go...
It's got very large springs, which kind of got caught and then had, quite a ping. This one's in a little, like, shock mount.
Oh, that's nice.
And, it's in the table better. And
that's good. It was cheap, the one I got you before. I did cheap out.
By cheap,
and whereas this one is expensive. Yeah, well, evidently.
It seems better, and I can, like, talk properly in the microphone, which was also another bugbear of yours, Joe, because I constantly miss the microphone.
Constantly.
Because, like, I'm excited. I'm an excited man.
No, because, Matt, you sound check like this, and then you spend the podcast talking over here. That's what's difficult about you.
But yeah. It's important to keep you on your toes, Joe.
I agree.
With the Guitar Nerds host, we've got a separate group chat without you. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we each come up with ways that easy and fun ways to annoy you this week.
That's good. That makes sense.
Yeah, Naomi's put forward some great suggestions, so I look forward to that next week.
Great, fantastic, wonderful. Thank you.
It's not like the loudness war of, like, the late 90s, Joe, where you're just like compressing music. You're just like, nah, compressor on max, that'll be fine. You know, you've got to ride the controls, Joe, real time.
Okay. Thank you for your recommendations. I do appreciate it. Actually, I mean, you know, think about it. It's like, you know, I am using the same microphone to podcast now that we bought maybe, I don't know, 4 years ago. I want to say 4 years ago, and I'm still using this Neat Bumblebee. And Jay, I think you've been using your Neat. You've got the grade down from me, but also a Neat mic.
No. I sold that on eBay, and I'm on the phone. This is through WhatsApp. It's just my phone mic.
I see.
Sounds good, actually. I'm surprised.
Great. Well, you know, you've had that for several years, whereas Matt, on the other hand, you seem to break a microphone at least yearly.
Not this one.
No. Well, not yet. Yeah. That's a new one. You've only had it a couple of months, but... I don't know what you do with them, Matt. I don't know where you put them or how you throw them around, but, you know, you seem to... You seem to get through them.
I'll keep this one nice and safe.
Thank you. Thank you, Matt. Thank you. Anyway, we should welcome aboard our new Patreon backer, Cyrus Haskell. Thank you for joining our Patreon team, Cyrus, which is great because, of course, he's joined us the week after we talked about Cyrus's question on the Patreon exclusive episode of the Guitar Nerds.
Oh, yeah. So he's here for a one and done. That's what it
well,
is.
Exactly.
Well, I mean, that's see, fine. Bloody legend. Good no, on
it's
him. Fine.
Yeah, it's good. So it got me thinking. I'm going to try and actually talk about different listener questions each week on the Patreon, actually do it, or at least tell them that we're doing it on the main episode. So
I think that's the way to go. It's just tell people
to sign up.
Do it. Yeah,
yeah,
exactly.
Yeah. But make sure we're telling people who aren't patrons, so they'll then pay money to hear it. And then afterwards, it doesn't matter if it's there or not, because they paid.
Well, yeah, I mean, you can't cancel the first month, whatever you do. So,
exactly.
Yeah, happy
exactly.
days. Joe, I think that is a really clever and unpredatory business model. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And yeah, good on you. Good
Thank
on you.
Thank you. Unpredatory is my middle name, so... Thank you. But yes, anyway, let's talk about some guitar stuff. Abe Matthews on the
we'll be talking about Abe's question on the Patreon. Join us now.
but seriously, Abe Matthews on the Facebook group. I tell you what, I am actually talking about a few things that listeners have posted on the Guitar Nerds group on Facebook. Half because, you know, dear listener, if you're not part of the group, please join in. It's such a fun discussion. I learn so much from that group every day. So, you know, join in if you're not already a part of the Guitar Nerds group on Facebook. But also, Abe Matthews pointed out that whilst I have been collecting, you know, plugins, and we will, of course, talk about Plugin of the Week again shortly. Whilst I've been collecting plugins, Abe has been collecting 500 series preamps. I kind of thought this was the sort of thing that was right up your street, Matt, because it kind of got me thinking, is this something I should get into? You know, is
the answer
Matt,
is always yes.
So, Matt, do you own many 500 series? I don't really understand what a 500 series is. Or 500 series thing is. They're like the little mini bits of rack that I know that JHS did a bunch of their pedals in.
Yeah, so from what I understand, and no, I don't have any. I was like, oh, I haven't bought many pedals recently. I sort of maybe I've got enough. And then I've realized I bought loads of recording gear recently, and I've been like trying to dive way more into recording, like, you know, bought Easy Drummer and some like DI boxes and stuff, and I'm like, oh, I'm just spending it on something different. But yeah, 500 series is still, it's like 2U rack height, but they're like little insert consoles like you'd get on a big mixing desk.
Like on a modular synth.
Yes, basically, but they are, you know, EQs, mic preamps, you know, you can get effects and stuff as well. So it's like what you route your signal into to record, or if you're going to reamp and, you know, send your signal out back into a desk. So it's almost like you can buy these little 500 series like lunch boxes that you can put like four modules in or six modules in. So you can take them to a recording session, and you've got your favorite mic preamp and your favorite compressor and stuff like that as well, which is, that's actually pretty cool. I think, you know, especially for more portable musicians now, if you go to a session and you're a guitar player, you can be like, oh, I always run my bass through this particular DI and compressor, or I really like mixing drums, but I really like always using this EQ. So you can have those in a kind of setup. And you can also buy them in, you know, you can, if you've got rack space in your desk or whatever, you can put them in there. So I think actually if you're into recording more at home and doing sort of more production, I think it's actually quite a cool way to have some nice outboard gear rather than maybe, you know, always working in the box and just using plugins.
Yeah, yeah, of course. I mean, I guess that's the argument. And the thing that I kind of come up at a little bit at odds about, like, if as soon as you're using outboard gear, it means you're committed to that sound when it's recorded. And that's the advantage of a plugin, really, is the constant ability to manipulate it no matter what, you know. And you might want to manipulate something depending on what you add in addition to that on the track, which always seems to me to be the reason that I would favour a plugin. But, of course, when it comes to sound quality, certainly when it comes to a preamp, I can see the advantage of that. One of the things that Abe was suggesting was this Camden series by the Camden 500 by Cranbourne Audio, who are a little UK company. It looks like they won a bunch of stuff from like SOS Editor's Pick of in Gear of the Year 2018. They were a highly commended 2019 SOS Award. They were it looks like actually they just got loads of awards from the same place. But you know, nonetheless.
In fairness, I guess the thing is it's like, where else are you getting gear like this reviewed except for Sound on Sound in the UK?
Yeah,
like,
yeah, I think exactly. You know, you make a good point, Joe. I mean, you know, a lot of interfaces now have got like a high Z input, you know, for guitar impedance, and then you've got great plugins. But I think there's a lot to be said about, well, things like microphones and stuff. So having like proper mic preamps, like you'd have like on a channel strip on a desk, that double up as a really powerful DI box. So if you're doing a lot, if you're an acoustic player, you can't really plug straight in. And a lot of the times, if you're just plugging straight into an interface, you're relying on digital plugins to like do a lot of the signal processing, where actually what you want is the best possible sound quality going into your interface. That's what, you know, that's what you want. And then of course you can manipulate it afterwards, but having a really nice mic preamp and, you know, being able to control and tailor the sound for maybe different microphones you're recording or, depending on what you're doing, I was looking at this Radial HDI DI box. It's the most expensive DI box that Radial makes, like £800.
Wow.
But it's a custom, like, Jensen Transformer HD DI box that basically looks like a little amp head that's got, like, a compressor and stuff built into it. It's really designed for bass players, but they're like, this is what a bass player should just take to a session and plug into that. You've got a DI out, but then you can go out into an amp as well.
No, but that's so expensive.
I know. So I think it's things like that. I mean, we were talking just before the podcast, I bought a Radial J48. I mean, I could plug straight into my interface, but I found that I like having the through, so I can still plug into an amp at the same time, so I can monitor through an amp, but then I can record a direct dry signal, and I'm recording a slightly better quality DI signal that I would be plugging straight into my interface. I mean, any excuse to buy more things is good. And a lot of brands, like you say, a lot of brands are doing 500 series modules now as well. So that's quite cool.
It's the year of home recording, isn't it? So
yeah, I think it's, I mean, honestly, I've been, I spent about 5 or 6 hours just like playing around, just like recording. I'm like, I wish I'd started doing this 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And just like getting into it now, I'm just like, I have some time, you know, I have a bit more time to kind of dive into things. I'm just like, man, like I'm just having so much fun. I had so much fun writing a track and writing the drums at the same time.
Mm.
And actually writing a song. I was like, this is the first song I've ever finished. And I think, yeah, I honestly know it's been a crazy year and a difficult year for so many. I'm so thankful to be able to have the opportunity to actually like sit in front of a computer and actually do some recording and write some music. And I think so many other people have been able to do the same thing. So I think we are seeing a lot more people buy gear for home recording because, you know, you've got the opportunity to do it.
Well, people have just, you know, a lot of people have have had to invest in the infrastructure to be able to work from home. And I mean, you know, how much extra investment or how much extra time and effort really do you have to put into plugging in a DI into your existing work setup in order to be able to play guitar and record it?
Yeah,
you know, not very much. You know, realistically, I have managed to find a way to put together like a pretty comfortable, I mean, the office that I have put together for myself is an absolute tip, but you know, that is kind of my own problem. You know, I've put together a pretty compact little area where I'm able to work, and I could easily just do a bit of home recording if I wanted to. I just I haven't got around, the problem is I haven't got around to listening to the There was this really great series on how to do kind of, you know, learning to record from home. And I haven't got around to listening to it yet. So it was by some guitar podcast, I'm not sure. But, you know, I think people have invested in that, and it seems like an easy place to go, really.
Yeah, I think the one tip that I would give to anyone now is you can do it really simply with just like really basic interface and a pair of headphones. But no matter what setup you're using, have it in a way that it's good to go as soon as you want to start playing. So you don't have to like, oh, I've got to get all these cables out. Because as soon as you start doing that, as soon as you get to that point of like hitting record, you're like, no, it's gone. So like I've got mine set up now, literally DI box is always on, always running. So all I need to do is load up Studio One and then I can just like start going. And I think so, before I'd been like, oh, I'll pack everything away. And then when I come to like wanting to write something or record something, I'll plug everything in. And it just never works. Because that's...
I agree. I think that's the best piece of advice. You know, I took it a step further and built like a so I can open a track on Studio One, and I built a preset which I can drop onto a track, which is essentially my amp settings. So all I have to do is open two tracks, both you know, recording to the same input. Both of them have the Presonus fat channel tube compressor on them, and then both of them have the that Ampeg amp sim that we were talking about the other week, that was like, I think it was free, wasn't it? I think it was free on the at the time. It was like £100 amp sim from, was it Waves? I think it was Waves that did it. And so it was the Ampeg VR, and I just have two of those in like Billy Sheehan style. So one of them's all the treble cut and all the bass boosted, and one of them's all the treble boosted and all the bass cut. And I can just drop that onto two channels and it's good to go. Like it's saved and preset in my exact sort of thing with the compression and the amps where I want them to be. So now I'm kind of even practicing, I'm just like, oh, I'll just drop these in and play from here.
Yeah, it's making a quick and clean and easy setup just makes things so easy.
Yeah.
And yeah, having a template saved in a, you know, in your DAW so you can just kind of click and go just works. But yeah, it's the funny thing for me was I did a bunch of recording on Saturday. I wrote this song on acoustic, and I was like, oh, I'm going to mic up an acoustic, and you know, had my SM57. I was like, doesn't SM57 work for acoustic? And loads of people are like, yes, it does. I'm like, great. It's the only microphone I own. And I wrote this drum track and I recorded it and I listened to the next day and went, I cannot believe how bad my timing is. And I listened back to it and I was like, oh my God. I was like so behind the beat. I was like, I can't be that lazy.
Were you listening to the drums as you played it?
Yeah. Yeah, so I was playing along to a drummer, and I was just like, and I was like jamming along. I was like, oh, I love it, I'm the best. And then listened back to him, I was like, oh my God, I'm terrible. Did you ever practice to a metronome? I never practiced to a metronome, and I never did. And this is the thing I'm saying. I wish I'd started
definitely not
10 years ago and just played along with some drums.
Song as well, Matty?
No.
Oh, mate, you got to record a little bit of vocals.
No, what I want to do is I want to record.
Be a love song.
Yeah, well, actually, it was funny enough because I started playing a song that was like chords, and Amy came in and went, really like that song. It's better than that sort of like ambient guitar that you like playing all the time. And I was like, yes. I want to get to the point where, kind of like me and Joe did with the recording sort of series of Joe writing and then back and forth some ideas. I started, literally had one band rehearsal about 5 days before lockdown. With another like singer-songwriter, and so I want to get to the point where I can do a lot of stuff here and then send the stems over and they can record vocals back and then, you know, sort of actually try and write some music, but yeah, do as much remotely as possible.
Do it. Easy Drummer seems like a wonderful solution for that, like, you know, what's the one I've got? I always forget the name.
Have you got Addictive Drums?
I've got Addictive Drums. That's it. Yeah. You know, both are very similar and excellent. And, you know, we
yeah, I would say, especially for like, you know, Jay, if you want to do some stuff like Easy Drummer, It's wicked because you can just find one drum part you like and then be like, hit the Sun Crater. And it's like, yeah, can you just give me like verse, chorus? And they'd be like, yeah, if you tried
all
of these
parts.
That's
about two pieces too many for me.
Yeah, verse, chorus, verse, intro.
That was, I think I've talked about this on a podcast before, but I used to play in this like kind of emo band and we like kind of like hardcore. Well, I play in this punk band and I wore a cardigan and wrote and sang sad songs over it. So, you know, basically it became an emo band. But basically our like mantra on the whole thing was write a good bit. Yeah. And then write another good bit. And that's the end of the song. So like all of the songs are like, it's two bits. And very rarely did any of them repeat. So like you could call
that's
one
cool.
verse and
I'm
one
into
chorus.
That.
But
that's
it's just,
pretty
I mean,
progressive, to be honest, Jay. I'd call you guys a progressive rock band. Yeah,
Progressive, yeah. Well,
because
I mean,
that's movements. You're working in movements rather yeah, okay. than repetition, you know.
Okay, like, yeah.
One of my favourite prog bands is a band we got to tour with. I've completely forgotten their name.
God damn it, what is wrong with my brain? Well, whilst you think about that, I'll explain.
Yeah, I think
the,
about
the,
that. Yeah, you carry on.
The 7-inch that we put out was six songs in, I think, 4.5 minutes. So, you know, it was a bit of a waste of time putting a
was
record
that,
out.
Was that, yeah, was that the limitation of the vinyl press, though? It's like, oh, I really want to press
No, no,
like
no. In fact, quite the opposite. They were like, fellas, like, There's not enough music on here. Like, I mean, well, there wasn't any music on there, let's be honest. But like, you know, there's not enough data. We need more stuff to get on here. But no, never an issue.
Well,
but yeah, well, write another good bit. I was on Twitter this week and I saw Laura Jane Grace from the band Against Me.
Oh yeah.
Said something, tweeted something that I found really inspiring because, you know, we've talked a little bit about how I've really tried to, like, I've really wanted to do a bit of recording and like write some songs, but I've just found the whole thing I found sitting down and doing it very uninspiring. I've been very uninspired, put it that way, because like I have always played guitar to play in a band, and playing in a band at the moment just, I realize it's closer than it's been for a long time, but it still feels so far away. And so like finding the kind of inspiration to sit down and be like, right, I'm going to write a song and I will be able to play this in front of people at some point just feels like this insurmountable journey. But I saw Laura Jane Grace like respond to someone who basically asked the same question. And she just said like, just go and write a song about anything. Like go take G, C and D, write a song and sing a song about your fridge, write some lyrics about your kitchen appliances. And you don't ever have to play that song for anybody. But like the fact that you're still writing and you're still pushing the creative, like pushing your creative buttons to like put something together that is a song is really important. So I found that really inspiring this week. So I think I am actually going to do it. I'm going to try and sit down and probably won't write a song about my fridge, but like I might just write a song that like, you know,
about
nobody will ever hear. About you, maybe about your fantastic moustache. Maybe I'll do that, Joe.
Thank you. Thanks, Jay. I appreciate that. I did remember the band's name, by the way. I don't know what's wrong with me. They're very good friends of mine, Bodyhound. They're a fantastic, fantastic prog band. They have this whole rule where they never repeat themselves. They never repeat anything in any song.
Is that like, so I'm sorry, I haven't a clue?
Sorry, what?
Like, I'm sorry, I haven't a clue, where they can't, you know, they can't use the same words twice, otherwise they get buzzed out.
Oh, I guess so. I don't know what that is, but yes.
Oh, it's like that Radio 4 quiz, like comedy show. Okay, so don't worry. Well, it doesn't matter. That was a bad joke, obviously. Well,
I enjoyed it.
I forgot about the, you know, where we are. This isn't really a Radio 4 type audience,
really.
Is it?
No, I don't really listen to radio. I listen to Atletico Mints, but that's about it.
Yeah, with, what's his name?
Exactly, yeah, exactly.
Bob Mortimer.
Yeah. Mortimer. Yeah,
exactly. It's very good. It's very good. Did you
see him on Taskmaster? You watched Taskmaster?
No.
Oh, mate. Like, Taskmaster, it starts again real soon. It's like my favourite television programme at the moment, except for the football. Taskmaster's so good. It's like, you should watch it. It's really good. I kind of always stayed away from it because I thought, this is just sort of like BBC comedians doing things that they think are funny. And actually, It's amazing. It's great, great television. And Bob Mortimer was on a season of that, and I highly, highly recommend it.
Well, if Bob Mortimer's on it, then I'm already invested. Now, to kind of bring the discussion away from, recording and stuff, momentarily and towards guitars, as we haven't really spoken about many yet, I wanted to talk about the whole Gibson Bass 6 thing, which is another topic that's kind of turned up on the Facebook group recently. I think someone had shared the kind of the 335 style, very, very rare Gibson Bass 6 on our group, because I think one had come up recently, and it'd been commented that someone else had said they preferred the solid body, which is of course the SG shape, which is maybe the most common of the Bass sixes, of course. And this this prompted us to talk about in our private chat the fact that recently on a guitar auction site there was an Epiphone Embassy style bass. The Bass 6, which had come up for auction, which I'd been like, yeah, I'm going to register to bid on this, because I'd kind of thought, no one knows anything about this. We're talking about an old 60s Bass 6 in that sort of Wiltshire body shape. No one's possibly going to want to purchase this. So I registered to bid, thinking like tops. It said it was listed as expected to go for between £1,000 and £2,000, and I was like, well, if no one's bidding on it, I could maybe stretch to that £1,000, mark. It went for £7,874.
A little bit outside your budget, even for Joe Money No Object Branton.
Yeah, exactly.
£7,500 was maybe a bit of a stretch.
It was. Yeah,
that's a shame. That's a shame. It was funny when that showed up in the group about 5 minutes after you said, "Oh, look at this, guys! Nobody's bidding on this. I'm going to bid for it." And then it was like, "Okay."
Yeah, exactly. But
so it's the way when you spot something and you think you're the only one who spotted it.
Yeah.
That's why I was really amazed that I'm sure many people who listen to this podcast the fans of Chris Buck, but he last year bought a 63 Strat at a local auction. He's in Wales, and I think he paid like a couple of grand for it, and there was a couple
what?
Of other people there, but no, I mean, it was in a terrible, terrible condition, but yeah, it was just like it'd been in someone's house for years and then just appeared in this local auction. But now so many auction houses are online as well. My dad spends loads of time in antiques auctions and stuff like that, and he's like always forwarding me like musical instruments or record collections is another one.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh man, like there's some great records here, and there's like estimate a fiver, and there was one I saw about a year ago. It was like someone had obviously collected like grunge records, and they had all these Nirvana pressings and stuff like that, and I'm like, man, there's some really collectible stuff in here. And then like I went back, I was like, they started to get out of hand price wise because you can watch them in real time now as well, and like one went for like £6,000, and just like it's a local auction in a tiny town in Suffolk. It's an unfortunate thing of the internet. That's why you can't go to a car boot and find a 59 Les Paul. Well, you probably can, but not so very, very unlikely.
But yeah, I mean, even with like records, the kind of the last bastion of like crate diggers for a long time was in charity shops and stuff like that. And I read a thing about how even charity shops nowadays are using Discogs. They'll get they'll get like a load of records dropped in, and they'll send a volunteer to go and sit on a computer and be like, okay, what pressing is this this Bad Brains recording? This is an original, better put this up I never got lucky in going through that sort of thing, but I think that's good. It's good that the charity shops are able to get like get the value of stuff as opposed to just like whatever.
There's a small town not far away from where my parents live. There's got a charity shop in, and they only do records. And so any record that goes into any shop in, there's like 50 in Suffolk and Norfolk, they send them to this one specific one, and they get a fresh delivery every Wednesday. And it's one of the best record stores I've ever been into.
Yeah, I bet.
And it's just run by volunteers who happen to also be like really into vinyl.
Well, why do you think that is? Everyone jonesing for that Wednesday morning shift. That's why.
So, but I think, you know, like you say, it is a good thing. And, you know, in some ways, I must admit, I was thinking about this the other day. Someone had dumped outside their house just down the road from me.
Oh, that's disgusting.
a 4x12 cab, but it was clearly an old WEM cab from the 70s. And I was like,
what?
Oh man, like I wonder if it's got like the original like Fane speakers in. The speakers are worth so much money. But then obviously like gutted it, because I then like tipped the back over and it's like, oh, it's empty. Someone had like ripped the bat, like the badge was half hanging off and stuff like that. And I'm just like, I'd sort of feel weird if someone was like, I'm chucking out this guitar I found in, you know, my partner's loft, and you open it, it's like a 59 Les Paul, and you're like, I'll give you £50 for it. I don't think I could do it.
No,
you know, it'd just be like this.
Well, I mean,
worth.
You know, in a more real world example of that, it's similar things used to happen when we worked at GAC, and people would come in and say, look, I've got this guitar that I want to sell. I don't really know what it's worth. What can you offer me, or whatever? What can you tell me about it? You know, there were plenty of times when we could have ripped people off, but I think. And I'm sure that people do get ripped off when they in those sorts of situations. It's just unfortunate that Matty and I are of extremely high moral standing. You know, it's not like when someone unfortunately would come in on a day when Marky P was sat at the desk and be like, oh yeah, no, 50 quid for that one, mate. 50 quid for that one.
Classic, you know? Mark Peckham. Yeah. I mean, yeah. I appreciate we've been off topic a lot, but like, but just on that note, that's, you know, exactly what happened to my dad, as in, you know, a good Samaritan helped out with, I'm sure I've told this story on the podcast probably before, and I've certainly told you before, but the story of the bicycle that I used to cycle as a kid, which was an old rally grifter. And when my dad came to sell it on eBay for 50 quid, only this was maybe 10 years ago now, sort of, he came to sell it on eBay, popped it up for 50 quid, and he kept getting people offering him 150 quid, 200 quid, 300 quid, just in direct messages for him to just take it down and list it then. And then some fellow very kindly messaged my dad and said, look, I don't think you know what you have here, but if your serial number is correct, then you have the first prototype of the Rally Grifter, and it's worth thousands and thousands of pounds. Have I not? Maybe I haven't.
Maybe
so. I haven't. No, but yeah, that was essentially it. It was like a. It turned out after my dad did some research into it, there was like the Rally Grifter fan club, and like he'd found, you know, posts on there where someone had been like, you know, what's the oldest Rally Grifter, and the guy who runs the group had been like, well, I have the serial number two. The chairman has serial number one, but there is a zero that's gone missing. No one's ever seen it or heard from it. You know, it's obviously been scrapped somewhere. So that's the one that everyone's after. But of course, it doesn't exist anymore. And it was the one that I'd been cycling around,
going into the woods
exactly.
Going to get like doing jumps over trees and stuff like that.
That my dad bought in like a Harrow, you know, sort of car boot for a tenner or something. But yeah, that you know, that's essentially, you know, paying for my my two younger brothers to, you know, go into university if they should wish.
Wow, amazing.
When they're old enough. So yeah, he did very well off. He did a private auction on the Rally Grifter website and did very well off of it. But
oh,
yeah,
amazing! Oh, that's really cool.
Yeah, and all very because cool. This one, he would have sold it for 50 quid, you know, if that fella hadn't got in touch and pointed it out. Anyway, yes, I appreciate it. We've been well off subject. I did want to talk about the Gibson Basics thing, just because. My kind of question about the Gibson Basics thing is, they've done the Epiphone Newport model, they've done the SG, they've done the EB, the 335 style shape.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
But it's not something they've ever done. Every single one of those, they only ran for a couple of years. They were relatively unpopular. And it's not something that they've ever reissued since kind of the 60s. Whereas, you know, Fender and Squire have kind of made, you know, had great success in reissuing the Bass 6 throughout the years. And like, you know, why do you think this is an area that only Fender have managed to, like, why did the Gibson Bass 6 not take off? It just seems like such an obvious instrument to work for them. Like, if you were gonna,
I don't know though, because I think like it is quite niche. It's a niche instrument, you know. It's insofar as like, how does it really fit into like modern music? The Bass 6.
I guess so. Gibson are such a heavy brand, like, you know, a heavier brand than Fender in many senses. And you'd have thought a Bass 6 kind of works for that, doesn't it? It works as like a heavy instrument. Why is this not a?
Well, but again, it's that like in terms of how people make music in this day and age, when you say heavy, it's like metal is like heavy music is down tuned. It's not like an octave down, it's down tuned. People want to be able to play like, you know, drop D type chords and stuff like that. That's what people are doing with making kind of modern metal, I guess, and modern heavy music. It's not, I'm going to play a G shape, but it's an octave lower.
Yeah, yeah. I guess so. You just think that's it then, that even though it is a heavily drop-tuned instrument, it's not a baritone, it's a different kettle of fish. And I guess the, you know, you're more likely to see, in the example of the Fender Bass 6, you're more likely to see someone playing Cream covers than you are to see them play Meshuggah on it, sort of thing. And it's,
yeah,
I guess that's your point. Yeah, it just seems, you know, I look at the SG version of it and I'm like, this just looks like what companies like Electric Guitar Company and Dunnable sort of trying to make guitars, like these incredibly aggressive looking thick strung instruments. And I just thought it's weird, I guess, to me that this never took off, or that they never even bothered to reissue it an inch shorter with baritone strings on. It just seems like a strange thing for Gibson to not try to revisit. They just look incredibly cool.
But yeah, it's funny, isn't it? I guess it's just, like you say, it's just the needs of the time. And then it's only really now that this thing's cycled back round. But when you sent, or when I think that first popped up in the group, I can't remember. Was it the SG that popped up in the group, or was it?
No, it was the 335 that popped up in the group. And then someone had mentioned that they preferred the SG version. And it just made me think of the fact that, you know, that Epiphone Newport had come up so recently.
Someone had sent me, I'm guessing it was, I can't remember the one that was in the group, but one of the two pickup EB6s.
Oh, yeah.
So it's the semi-hollow, but with like two neck pickups, a neck and a middle pickup. Yeah. Humbuckers. I was just like, man, they're extremely cool. I guess, what was it really being used for then? I guess it was to play bass parts early on. People were playing, obviously. You know,
what do you think of George Harrison was playing bass parts on Beatles records, you know, after Paul McCartney had moved to the piano for a lot of stuff. And you think Cream were, Jack Bruce was playing a Bass 6 for a lot of Disraeli Gears. In fact, I think all of Disraeli Gears was recorded on a Fender Bass 6, you know, and that's just essentially he was looking for a Gibson bass tone. you know, and he went for a Fender Bass 6 to get that because it was a similar vibe.
Yeah.
I think like the Cocteau Twins are probably a band that are like well known for their use of the Bass 6. In terms of like
the Cure again, or you know,
the Cure, yeah, like Glen Campbell used one a lot, like the solo in Wichita Lineman is Bass 6.
Oh, it's
yeah, 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 yeah. That and that's an amazing. That's like an amazing. That song's amazing.
Hmm.
But it's just like, you know, I think the fact that we've, you know, reeled off four or five kind of obvious examples, and now it's like, yeah,
football, well, etc.
My mates band
only,
from
like,
Texas,
modern,
football, yeah, etc. They use one, you know, yeah, what I mean? Yeah. And it's like, but it's like,
and they've got the best looking one as well.
The Shell Pink matching headstock. Oh, yeah, yeah, totally. Yeah. But again, it's like she's just using it as a base. Like it's, yeah, not, you know, it's, that's the thing is, it's like, I think that the Bass 6 is just like, just in terms of like modern music, it's never really taken off.
Does and anyone so, need those high two strings, I guess, you know?
Well, and so it just kind of leads itself more to kind of, I guess, you know, the Squire one has been successful because it's at a price point where people might be like, yeah, I'd like to buy something different, something that I can add a bit of texture or something that I can mess around with at home, put through my delay pedals. You know, I think that's, I bet that's what a lot of those guitars end up doing is they get used for kind of ambient soundscapey stuff.
Well, I think we've used it on like polymath recordings for texture and stuff. But my one basically sits on my rack, and I was coming around to sort of sell a few of my guitars recently, and it came to the Bass 6, and I was like, I don't really use this, but then it's not really worth enough money for me to sell it. So it's fun. I'll keep it.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of how that Bass 6, the Squire Bass 6, and certainly I had before the Classic Vibe, I've got the vintage modified one, which is even cheaper, and obviously had some, you know, the bridge wasn't as good yet to change that out. They've fixed that on the Classic Vibe, but then you know
you talk about like why people like Dunnable or Electrical Guitar Company are doing well with them. It's like there's something else there as well. You know, there's a reason why people go for a Dunnable. There's a reason why people go for Electrical Guitar Company, as opposed to just saying, hello there, I would like to buy a Bass 6. What are your options?
Yeah.
You're probably being drawn towards, if you're buying like a Dunnable Bass 6, you're probably already being drawn to the fact that those guitars are like kind of metally and cool and interesting and like a progressive brand. And you know, likewise, Electrical Guitar Company, I mean, obviously I realize there's a bit more history there, but like it's not just I'm going to shop around for a Bass 6. Probably the opposite. It's probably someone saying, I want an Electrical Guitar Company guitar.
Absolutely.
Oh, look, they do a Bass 6. That's cool. I'll get that.
Just on this note, I don't think we talked about it last week, and I can't remember if I posted a picture of it in the group or in our one of our chats, but did you see that Wes Borland posted a picture of his new prototype from PRS?
Of course.
On his
we
Instagram.
Didn't. No one follows Wes Borland other than you, Matt.
So he posted a picture of his new four-string guitar bass with trem from PRS. So it's got, get this, not one.
Just looking at it.
Not two, but three EMGs, two humbuckers, and a single coil. But not in the HSH configuration. It's in a
SHH.
Yeah. With a volume 4 guitar and a volume 4 bass. With a trem. I mean, this thing just looks...
Wait, no. SHH.
Yeah. This thing looks mad.
HSS.
The...
SHH. That's what you'd...
SHH.
Yeah. SHH. SHH. Yeah, so the single coil is like right up by the...
on the neck join.
Which I assume is dealing with the bass. I assume that one's going to deal with most of the bass frequencies and then the humbucker for guitar. The low string on this four string looks substantially thicker than the other three on this prototype as well.
Yeah, I wonder what it is. I wonder what gauge it is. What,
two inputs by the looks of it as well. One for bass, one for guitar.
One bass and guitar, and then bass and guitar volume, I guess that is. And then, yeah, weird. What's that trem as well? Is it an Evertune or something?
No, it's something weird and custom. It's got a little name on the bottom, but I can't see from this picture.
Fred Durst likes this post.
Oh, here you go. So someone's asked, the string gauge is 80, so it's an 80 low E. So, you know, that's quite light. So 80, 42, 32, 22, and it's tuned AADG.
Brilliant. I'm in.
So it's basically
it's
just
a three string with a drone note. So it's a three string with a drone note.
Yeah, so basically it's a so it's essentially as though you've got a six string electric guitar, you're using heavy strings on it, and you've detuned the E to an A. So then you've got AADG. Yeah, so basically as if that's essentially what it is. It's like you're using, so if you're using baritone strings, which traditionally would be like 13 to 72 or something like that, he has detuned the E to an A, and then the A, D, and G remain the same. So actually the three higher strings probably aren't, it's probably not that different to playing, you know, what's skinny top, heavy bottoms. I bet it's the same gauge as skinny top, heavy bottoms, because they're 10 to 52. Sorry, whilst I Google. So 42. Okay, so it's a little bit heavier. So the A, D, and G on skinny top, heavy bottoms are 42, 30, 17. So, you know, it's actually not a million miles away from just like regular heavy guitar tuning with an 80 for the low string. But yeah, it's just a drone string, essentially. Really cool. Really interesting.
He's been playing a four string for a while. I didn't realize he's had other four string.
Yeah,
models.
A lot of... Yeah, Significant Other. I think quite a lot of the guitar parts on that are this. I think he played a PRS or similar, and then only had four strings on that. And actually, if you scroll back through his posts 9 weeks ago, here I am with a Bass 6. So there's another Bass 6 user, Wes Borland. Wow. But yeah, I mean, I can't ever see the... I mean, I'm sure there's a lot of Wes Borland fanboys, i.e. me, that would buy one. Yeah, madness.
It's cool. I mean, when was the last time PRS did a signature? I mean, when's the last time PRS did a bass, apart from anything? But
I think, can you still buy PRS bass?
Yeah, they did the Kestrel, didn't they?
Yeah, I guess. But are they SE or were they?
They were SE. Yeah.
I don't remember that at all. PRS Kestrel.
They've been doing it for a while. I'm scrolling back through a bunch of posts, and he's posted a bunch of pictures of other PRSs that he's played that are a similar setup. So madness. Madness.
Yeah, kinda no, want... I like it. It looks
yeah,
cool.
I know. I kind of want one. I'm like,
yeah,
with a bunch of gain and some, a bunch of delay. I bet that thing sounds amazing.
I wonder if you could probably run both outputs at the same time and send one to, how about that? Run both, like, come out both outputs and then, like, go into, like, put the guitar input into, like delays and reverbs and stuff, and put the bass input into just like drives and like keep it kind of clean.
Yes.
So that you've got all sorts going on. I bet that'll sound wicked.
Yes.
Really cool. It's a amazing. Really cool idea. I'm very into this. The four string guitar sounds like something I can play as well. So, you know.
And just scrolling back, he's playing a Bass 6 here. It's got a picture of his pedal board. Not one, not two, but four Boss Delay pedals.
Wow.
It's pedal boards. And
was this all just a setup to talk about that, Matty?
Yes, that was just to say that welcome on board, Wes Borland. I mean
Matt didn't mention the post about 2 weeks after that where he bought an HX FX, but you know, that's fine.
Yeah, no. Ridiculous. I'd love to meet him. Also, because his main amps, I think, are Jazz Choruses. So,
oh, really?
Limp Bizkit, Jazz Chorus.
There you go. How about that? Well, very cool. Very cool. Dear listener, go check it out on I think it's The Wes Ball on Instagram. You just check out his cool guitar. It's very cool. Now, I do want to mention, because I've been trying to mention the plugin of the week each week. I promise we'll talk about guitars again after this. But this plugin of the week was actually suggested by Andy Manley on the Guitar Nerds Facebook group. Something from Black Rooster Audio. You can check them out on blackroosteraudio.com. Now, Black Rooster Audio do a whole bunch of very, very cool plugins, which I will talk about in a bit. But the one Andy Manley mentioned is one of their free plugins. That's right, dear listener, it's completely free. Their Cypress TT15, which is kind of an orange tiny Terra amp sim, but completely free. It's green. It looks gorgeous, actually. The graphics for the amp are very good. But, you know, kind of similar things are very simple. You've got gain, volume, and a master tone, the same as you would an Atari Tiny Terra, with a couple of flick switches for kind of, you know, selecting the gain frequencies and the overall kind of EQ shaping. But, you know, this would cost you absolutely nothing. Sounds absolutely fantastic from all the little demo videos I've seen of it. Like a really strong contender. And, you know, absolutely worth getting, as it costs nothing. If you're looking for an orange amp, an orange style amp in a plugin, then, you know, most companies charge a lot more than nothing for a decent one. So very, you know, very worthwhile getting. But, you know, Black Rooster Audio actually makes some fantastic stuff. They were one of the first companies to really get on board with the whole isolation thing. They introduced their Stay Home bundles. They did their Stay Home and their Stay Home 2 bundle, where you could get every single plugin that they do, which I think was... £811, which would be if you bought every single plugin individually, you'd get them for £133.
Wow, yeah.
I appreciate, listener, we're talking, you know, a lot of money for plugins. £133 is relatively expensive when we're just talking about a free one. But, you know, the fact that it was, £133 instead of £811 is fantastic. And they do a wonderful range of things, everything from their magnetite, which is kind of like an Abbey Road tape reel style mastering plugin, to their vintage, their RO140, which is a lovely vintage plate reverb, which I have. It's excellent.
Have you seen the other free one they've got at the moment? They've got two free ones at the moment. So there's the Canary Cypress TT, and they've also got one called the Canary.
Yes.
Which is specifically for drums. So Matty, maybe something that you would be interested in to go with your Easy Drums. So the Canary was designed to support you in creating the most powerful and convincing drums you have ever recorded or mixed. This plugin lets you expand and recover some fundamental aspects of the drum signal that may have been lost during the recording process or which haven't been there in the first place. Spooky. You know, if it's going to make your electronic drum sound a bit more analog and a bit more IRL, then, you know, might be worth downloading and letting us know what you think, Matty.
I am on it right now. If I download and restart my computer, that's why I disappear.
Yes, he couldn't wait to get some Easy Drums going through the Canary.
There you go. But yes,
the tagline here is "Make sure drums sing," which I like a lot. I think that's really good. I wonder if they came up with the tagline before the name. I bet they did.
Yeah, they. The entire range of Black Rooster Audio bits and bobs are incredibly, incredibly good. I got their VLA FET compressor some time ago in a sale for it's £80. I think I got it for like £40. But of course, you know, even that is you know, like, you know, nearly a quarter of the cost of getting everything. So I've been had there, really. I should have gone for the stay at home bundle. But they're very good. I thoroughly recommend them. And yeah, check out that little, the Cypress, the little orange preamp. It's very, very good. Now, we should talk about some news things this week as we hurtle towards the end of the podcast. Because there have been a whole bunch of, like, it seems to be a week for custom shops. You know, we've got, like, this rad new line of kind of Gretsches for 2021, which have been around for a while. We just haven't spoken about them. The Ernie Ball BFR series, a very interesting. ESP have put out their Exhibition Limited series, which is, you know, hilarious because there are no exhibitions. The Fender have done their Prestige collection. And Gibson, and let's talk about that first, Matt. Gibson have launched, or is it relaunched? I feel like it's a relaunch of the Murphy Lab collection.
Well, so let me tell you about this. So for the longest time, especially when we worked more so at GAC, I didn't see as many at Anderton's, but there was always this rumbling of, can you get a Tom Murphy Les Paul? Can you get a Tom Murphy Les Paul? So for those people listening who don't know, Tom Murphy is renowned as like the best, one of the best guitar ages, you know, someone who basically relicked guitars in that kind of scene.
He's like picking the wrong grail in Indiana Jones.
Yeah, he was the person that was responsible for, so Gibson always did some level of aging, but he like did the best aging, and you could always tell. Or you knew it was one of his because he signed a little T and an M into the relicking lacquer checks.
Lacquer checking.
Into where the volume, the bottom volume and tone were. And they commanded like mega money. And even now, you know, on a couple of the like Les Paul groups that I'm in on Facebook, you see people going, oh, I've got a Murphy aged. And like, they're just like mega money. They started at like $8,000. But yeah, he was never a full-time employee of Gibson. And now he is, effectively. So the Murphy Lab, he has now trained a small selection of staff up to his level to be able to offer 50 brand new Tom Murphy or Murphy Lab guitars. Alongside that, you can now, on Made to Measure, select light, medium, heavy and very heavy Murphy Lab relicking options.
Wow.
Ultralight, light, heavy and ultra heavy. So you can order those on Made to Measure. So you can say, I want a one pickup pink Les Paul custom in heavy, ultra heavy aging, and they can do that. But off the shelf, as it were, 50 brand new Murphy Lab guitars. So that ranges from a aged 54 Les Paul all the way through to, get this, you know, you'd expect your 58s and your 59s, 63 Firebird 5 in frost blue, ultra heavy. There's some 335s, which are pretty cool. And you've got things like 64, 335 in, light aged, or a Firebird 5 with Vibrola in heavy aged.
What sort of price are these things coming in at?
They are not cheap. So obviously Les Pauls are the most expensive, which you would expect. So if you want a, let's just pick here, can you filter this by price? No, you cannot. 1960 Les Paul Standard Tangerine Burst, heavy aged, $8,999.
God, that's expensive. Can it be cheaper if I don't get it in a crap finish like Tangerine Burst?
No, so these ones are preset. So these are the guitars that I'm assuming they are offering all year round. So this ranges from your like 58 Lemon Burst, your 59s, your 335s, basically a range of all guitars that they currently make out of the custom shop, including a 1960 Les Paul Junior double cut in ebony, heavy aged, not cheap at $7,799, but looks amazing. So I think this is basically for them, this is the next step in them offering aged and relic guitars.
Wow.
Taking
that premium service to a new level.
Yes, I think it's, I guess people have always, like with Fender, have wanted relicked guitars, and Gibson have never really offered it. Like we used to get them relative. We always used to have a few at GAC, but now it's...
They were fine, though, weren't they, before? They were fine.
The Murphy ones were always the best ones.
Yeah.
And it wasn't just that he had aged them. They actually generally just, like, felt better.
Yeah.
And just played better. But, yeah, now you can order that on Made to Measure, which is, I think is wicked. You know, there used to be a massive waiting list. I think I remember talking to some... friends that work in other retailers, you know, after I sort of left working in retail, and they'd be like, oh yeah, we've waited like 3 years for this one particular Murphy guitar, and it was already sold like within a month of us saying that we're going to get it. So wow. I think it's cool. I'm
got
guessing
any EB6s on there?
Yeah, yes. EB6 heavy age Todd Murphy. It's about 50 grand. So yeah, amazing that they can offer that, and they're going down that route. Gibson are kind of, I guess, listening to what people want and saying, well, here you go, basically. Very cool. So very, very cool. And then just on their website now, if you go to their custom models, obviously there's a bunch of stuff on there in their standard custom range as well. But yes, a whole range of just amazing guitars out there now from Gibson that hopefully will filter into more shops and more accessible to the people out there that want them. I've just spotted they're doing a black 1964 Trini Lopez with stop tail, which looks amazing.
Oh, that's what you want. Have you ever owned a 335 style guitar, Matt?
I had a 339.
Yeah. Did you? I don't remember that.
Yeah, but a 175 is my ultimate.
I got one of those.
175 or a 125 T, which is the thin line. We had one in GAC for a while, which was amazing. But yeah, 175. I've always wanted a one pickup 175.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
One neck pickup.
One neck pickup. That's what you want.
175. But yeah, I mean, obviously the three pickup one, any 175, amazing.
If anyone's listening, Matt will accept it. If you've got like a two pickup one knocking about that you just, you know, you want to send to Matt, he won't turn it away just because it's got two pickups. It's essentially what you're saying, Matty, right?
Yes. Yeah. Exactly.
Any donations gratefully received.
Have you ever owned a 335 style guitar, Jay?
No, I've not. I've thought about it. 339 has always been, I've always preferred the idea of.
Why is that?
I don't know. I think it would just make me look comically massive, I think, is the... I think I quite like the idea of that. I don't know, really. I haven't ever had one. I've not had like a Dot or... I mean, I had a Gretsch for a while. You know, if we're talking about hollow bodies, I had a Gretsch for a long time, actually, like a 50... I think it was a 5125 or something like that. It was like your classic kind of Gretsch Electromatic with, but it had Dan Electro single coils in it. So it was when Fender was distributing.
DeArmond?
I mean DeArmond, yeah, of course. Yeah, not Dan Electro. So it was when Fender, I think Fender was distributing DeArmond for a time. Or no, DeArmond was part of Guild. There's some sort of lineage there that I don't really understand. But yeah. I think that's it. I think DeArmond was a part of Guild, and it was when Fender was distributing Guild.
I see.
And so there was a range of Gretsches that came with that. That was actually a guitar that I bought from the aforementioned sales hawk, Marky P, when I went into GAC to buy a Telecaster, and he basically said, no, you can't buy a Telecaster. You can buy this Gretsch because it's damaged and we need to get rid of it. And
I got bullied into it.
Yeah, I mean, that was like very, very early on in our friendship. This was probably 2004, 2005, probably, that happened. So like way before I started working at GAC. But yeah, I had that for a while, and it was great for what I was doing at the time, which was like abrasive ska punk.
Yeah,
and then after that, like, yeah, my love affair with Telecasters sort of blossomed, and now I play Strat, so you know. I've been thinking about hollow bodies again. I've been thinking about maybe going like dipping my toe back into the world of Gretsch's or maybe a casino or something. I don't know. Or 335 would be good, but they are expensive.
Yeah, I always liked 330. So the fully hollow ones. But actually, I was looking at Heritage also do a 335 and a 330 and have a custom shop as well. And some of the stuff they had at Winter NAMM this year was cool. But yeah, they do a 175 as well. I'm like, oh. Will they just knock a pickup out of the bridge? Don't put that one in. Save me some money. Don't cut that bit out. And then just put the neck one in.
I wonder if the Heritage...
Heritage is, 535 is
it?
535 is their kind of 335, I guess.
Oh, they're 335. Oh, yeah. I thought it was the 530. Is it not? No. Okay. Maybe not. Oh, yeah, the 535. You're absolutely right. Oh, the Eagle Classic is, you know, it's not quite a 175 because it's a rounded lower horn.
I think that's based. I'm guessing that's based off the old. I want to say Birdland Gibson Birdland. Yeah. I think we had something similar at GAC once, and they were super rare. They didn't make many of them, and that was like $9,000.
Yeah.
I think.
Well, it looks like these are what, like $4,799 US dollars, made on request, which is about. I mean, it's probably about the same as my ES-175, I guess. Like maybe a little bit more actually than my Gibson ES-175.
Yeah, I mean, I tell you what, specs wise, I mean, that 575 comes in with
535.
The 575. It's 399. That is their ES-175. I didn't see that initially, but yeah.
But they come with like proper Seymour Duncans and everything. But they also have an artisan aged program, which they do the 530 in an aged. I'm like, oh, that looks great with two P90s in it. I'm in.
Yeah.
Hollow bodies. I've always wanted one, and just I never owned one properly, but for very long. Sort of like had one and like flipped it, but that or a Gretsch. Obviously, I've always wanted a white penguin.
The penguin is your that's always been what you've
It's the bucket list. It's on there, and the only one I've ever seen in and actually I remember when I was in a shop was a left-handed one. So,
well, you could relearn.
I could.
Yeah, lazy.
Yeah, lazy. But yeah, one day. I can't even.
Have you ever
jazz.
Had a You ever had a hollow body bass, Joe? You had a Jack Bruce for a while, didn't you?
Not a Jack Bruce. The Warwick Jack Bruce. No, I didn't. I had the Jack Cassidy, the Epiphone Cassidy. Is that what you mean?
Of course.
Yeah. Jack Bruce had a very similar looking model, like 335 style with Warwick, but I never got that one. Yeah, I got the...
It was because you were talking about Cream earlier. Yeah. I had Jack Bruce on the mind. Yes, the Jack Cassidy was the one I was thinking of, yeah.
It was... the Jack Cassidy was fantastic. I got it in black. I kind of, every now and again, I regret selling it because it was one of those basses that looked incredibly cool, but... it didn't especially play very nice. It had that, you know, that sort of cheaper Epiphone feel. Mark's mentioned it before, where everything just feels like it's been just so overpainted. Like the paint is just so thick on it. It kind of feels like you're playing a bit of plastic sort of thing. It kind of had that sort of feel to it. I guess even though it was so cool looking, I just never clicked with it for some reason, which is strange because normally all I care about is how something looks. And it was very cool. It sounded fine. Like it just, I think it was a mix. this sounds daft, but one of the problems with it was, of course, it was a long scale hollow body, which makes it very uncommon because, of course, most hollow body basses are short scale as well. So essentially, there are no cases that you can get for this without getting something.
Funny you should mention that because there was the Jack Cassidy case.
Yes, yeah. But that's
and
not going
we
to
sold
be...
so many of them.
Hmm. Well, you've got to get one because it's not going to fit in anything else. It's not going to fit in any soft cases or anything like that.
Yeah,
and that
was
kind of the problem that I had. Like, I was like, well, it doesn't fit in any of my soft bags and I have like nice mono soft bags. So I was like, it's kind of, if I start using this properly, it almost renders all these wonderful gig bags redundant. And then the only hard case you can get for it is the Epiphone Jack Casty case, which isn't really tour worthy. Like, you couldn't fly that. Like, you could carry it to a show, but it's not like a Hiscox or anything like that. And I was like, I also have a number of Hiscox cases. You know, it doesn't matter what bass I get. I can always put them in my sort of bashed up Hiscox that's got my band logo on the front, and it's fine. And it's kind of, in getting the Jack Casty, I was like, I literally have to get new everything else just for this bass. And so I sort of, it just ended up sitting on a shelf, and I eventually sold it.
Surely you weren't allowed to play it anyway, were you? Didn't, because it didn't fit with the colour scheme.
Oh, no, I got it in black. They did a black
version with white
binding. Yeah, of course. I wasn't going to get the gold top or anything like that. No, everything has to be black or sunburst. So, you know, got it in that. But yeah, it was good. It was good. It was just, you know, not quite right. And of course, I have now commissioned a Moore, M-O-A-R, custom shop, Wayfair, which is their...
Of course, their thin line hollow body.
They're very thin 335. Yeah, so that'll be made this year. You obviously had a massive waiting list, but it's coming round to that one being actually made. So I've commissioned a 3 bass P90 with bass 6 switching, which is Jaguar switching, essentially. 335 style, slimline hollow body 4-string bass,
super slimline. I mean, it's basically 2D. Like, you don't want to be putting that in your guitar rack, mate. It'll disappear.
No,
like, you need to put that up on the wall. Otherwise, you're just going to lose it.
Yeah, exactly. I'll put it sort of side on, and then I won't be able to see it.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. But yeah, very cool. I will look forward to that. Anyway, that is that's actually all the time we have on this week's episode of the Guitar Nerds podcast. We're going to be continuing over on Patreon, so join us, dear listener, over there at patreon.com/guitarnerds for an entire extra episode now and every week. And you can become a Patreon supporter for as little as $1 a month. At the dollar tier, you get this episode ad-free and early. At $5, you'll get access to our Patreon special episodes, plus our entire back catalogue and all our mini-series. And at $10, you'll get the lot, plus I'll sing you my thanks at the end of every episode. I did a new song last week with a pretty cool rap. I was kind of going for a Sum 41 feel. I'm kind of trying to do different punk pop bands this year as my ending songs. But it got described as Alien Ant Farm-esque, but I guess that was the rapping. So, you know, it's fine. but you know, it's I'll get it right in the future. I'll try someone else next. I'm not sure who. Maybe it's time to do Limp Bizkit. Who knows? In a couple of weeks, I need some time to think of the idea. But anyway, you can also find us on all your favorite social media platforms and join the Guitar Nerds group on Facebook to get involved in our weekly episode discussion. Thanks for listening. You've been lovely. We've been the Guitar Nerds. Farewell.
Bye.
I did it over the Nookie. The Nookie!
Let me tell you all about my Patreon backers. Some of them are crazy, some of them are crackers. Playing the guitar all day and saying that the back hurts. Mudding all the squire broncos with the rafters. I am the host, but I never seen a ghost. No concert, ill flames, absolute glow. I just want retroness, I must confess. You Patreon backers are the best. It's like Eric Vaughn, John Conway, James Dodd, John Hackety, Paul G. Manning, Russell Healing, Ty Allen, Yogi the Guitarist, Kyle Harris, Kyle Lifter, and Todd Sands, Joe Hopper, John Hughes, Brian Hansen, Shane M. and Jeffrey Wax, Eric Hammer, Samuel Foss, Brian Einstein, Evan Vanderlinden, Andy Manley, Scott Udden, Robert Butterworth, Simon Milbourne, Marcus Alcata, Wacky, and Stuart Robson, Christian Lund, Hanson, Pete Adams, Michael McVeigh, and Eric Kyle, Lauren Peters, Joe Budget, Ryan McDermott, Jack Cupmore, Ken Sayers, Abe Matthews, Guy Tobia, the band Sean Arbo, John Anglin, Dr. Amadon, and Ernie Cooper, Russ Edwards, Nate Nagel, Stephen Burke, Aaron Sherman, Dave Lee, Jay Gray, Scott Kennedy, Blake Weiland, Christopher Loseth, Hans Ams, Derek Rich, Rob Nordvik, Steve Merkel, JD Short, and Brad Page, Andy McKenzie, and Robert Smith, Scott O'Brien, Paul Corrigan, Moo. Let me tell you all about my
Patreon backers. Some of them are crazy, some of them are crackers. Playing the guitar all day and saying that the back hurts. Mudding all the square brown coats with the raptors. I am the host, but I never seen a ghost. No concert here, flames absolute gold. I just want retroness, I must confess. You Patreon backers are the best.